listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM. Just remember, live your life.
Turn out for Wave Farms WGXE 90.7 FM's karaoke contest fundraiser at Half Moon in Hudson on Friday, May 10th. The evening will be hosted by karaoke Amanda of WGXE show Dim the Lights with Jenny and Amanda, with proceeds from ticket sales benefiting WGXE. The contest's theme is communication, so all songs related to dialing, radio, phone, internet, fax, and more are eligible. Choose your tune and sing it for our guest judges, Ariel and Gloria, of WGXE show Las Brujas Bilingües, and DJ Patty Boom of WGXE show Vinyl Freedom, to win prizes. Prizes include tickets to the Negative Land and Sue C., Matt Mos, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt show at the Greenville Drive-In and other goodies. Doors are open at 7 p.m. and karaoke contest begins at 8 p.m. If you can't turn out in person, tune in for a live broadcast of the event on the FM dial or online. For more information, visit the community calendar at wavefarm.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The Hudson Valley Picture Show traveling series brings cinema to locations around the region. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Nancy Barber and Bill Stone in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, May the 8th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. A new report shows the number of kids covered by Medicaid varied widely between states as pandemic area protections were lifted, with Alaska seeing a decline.
The Georgetown University report says nationwide, more than 4 million fewer children were enrolled in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program at the end of last year versus spring 2023, before the expiration of continuous coverage. Alaska saw a 9% drop in enrollment. The report estimates that in 70% of cases, children's coverage was canceled for procedural or red tape reasons, such as difficulty navigating the state's website, reaching a person via a helpline, or not receiving renewal notices. Trevor Storrs with Alaska's Children's Trust says since there haven't been any changes in eligibility criteria, procedural cancellations are likely.
More than likely, we have a significant number of Alaska children who are eligible for Medicaid, but were potentially dropped from the program during the unwinding process. And Alaska already had one of the highest rates of uninsured children, and this just adds to it.
Alaska was one of eight states that disenrolled so many children that it had fewer enrolled than prior to the pandemic. Brett Pivoteau reporting.
Currently in the state, Medicaid recipients must reapply each year. And the judge presiding over Donald Trump's criminal case in Florida on charges that he hoarded classified secrets at his Mar-a-Lago estate after his presidency has indefinitely postponed the trial, once scheduled for May 20th. That from Politico. They report the date had been widely expected to move amid a tangle of pretrial conflicts between special counsel Jack Smith and Trump's attorneys. Smith had urged Judge Eileen Cannon to reschedule the trial to begin on July the 8th, but an order from the judge Tuesday suggested that she is unlikely to even decide on a new trial date before late July. And a collaboration between the federal government and local communities works to create new career opportunities. The first Environmental Career Worker Apprentice Readiness Training Program is funded by the Biden administration's Justice 40 initiative.
Tony Johnson, a Black single father from Michigan, credits the program with altering his family's future. He started his carpentry apprenticeship in April 2024 and is now on track for a union job in Flint. Johnson says this is the only program he has ever been part of that has created a career opportunity.
Imagine going to college and after finishing your program, the instructor line you up with jobs and they keep in contact with you. They gave us connections and comfort and stability knowing that we're not in this alone.
Johnson stumbled upon the program by chance and thinks it needs promotion in more Michigan communities. It partners with community colleges, historically Black colleges and universities, and apprenticeship programs. Farah Siddiqui reporting.
This is Public News Service. Lagging salaries have meant teachers in Ohio and across the nation are experiencing a 5% drop in purchasing power, according to a new report by the National Education Association.
Last year, state lawmakers approved a 17% raise to the base annual salary for teachers from $30,000 to $35,000, and also agreed to fund the second phase of the state's Fair School Funding Plan. Scott DeMauro with the Ohio Education Association says those changes are silver linings, but notes Ohio has more work to do to alleviate shortages and retain educators in the field. He says state investment for teacher pay should be a priority.
I think there's a disproportionately high reliance on local revenues. So that would be dollars that come from local tax levies as opposed to from the state to fund our public schools.
1,300 school districts around the country saw starting teacher salaries reach or surpass $40,000 during the last academic year. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
And a Des Moines-based farm co-op is taking high-tech sports training into the country.
The field of high-tech sports training is usually reserved for athletes or other high-level performers. But that mindset is taking a dramatic turn as the Landis Farm Co-op in Des Moines has hired a physician. Dr. Dara Harris has spent much of her medical career training the Toronto Blue Jays minor league baseball players and is bringing those skills to the Iowa countryside. Harris says she's always been drawn to helping people who have to perform physically to make a living.
You don't have days off. You can't take it easy, right? It's that rub some dirt on it kind of world. And to be able to take the things that we've been learning in sports and in medicine and apply it to this group is just an incredible opportunity.
Phone. I'm Mark Moran.
Finally, Kathleen Shannon lets us know there are nearly 150,000 miles of rivers and streams in South Dakota, but new data shows many don't meet state standards for safe water quality.
According to the state's 2024 Surface Water Quality Report, nearly 80% of water studied don't meet the quality requirements for their intended uses, including recreation and aquatic life. The primary contaminants are E. coli and total suspended solids, which make rivers run brown. The report says some of the culprits are riverbank erosion, runoff from large farm operations, and sewage overflows. Travis Entenmann with Friends of the Big Sioux River says those can pose human health risks through drinking water.
When there's excess nutrients in the water, it takes more cost, energy, equipment, time, money that goes into cleaning our water before we can drink it.
Much of the contamination comes from non-point sources.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, May 8th. Local early morning temperatures range from 46 degrees in Steventown to 60 in Tannersville. Regional average soil temperature is 56 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium, coming down from yesterday. Today will be warm and rainy. Thunder may rear its head, especially in the morning. We get a high temperature of 78 degrees at 5 p.m. Precipitation ends by dark. Overnight, it should be dry and we get a low temperature of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, more rain, especially in the afternoon. High of 66 happens at 4 p.m. Rain continues all night and we see a low of 49. Friday, still rainy, high of 57 degrees. Saturday, the afternoon so far looks like light rain in the afternoon and a high of 61. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 3:29 a.m., then low tide at 10:26 a.m., high tide again at 4 p.m., and low tide once again at 10:28 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 60 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 7:47 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:37 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be average at 490 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty bad till dark, then okay below 15 megahertz. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 144. And this has been the Better Weather for May 8th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
You gotta try something.
You got a job at the radio station?
Oh, great, that place. It's dark and dirty and has, like, what, those three weirdos who work there?
Next, we hear a song inspired by Radio Alice, one of the Italian free radio stations, or one might call pirate radio stations, that flourished in Italy in the 1970s when there was little oversight from the government. The radio stations lived in harmony and sort of worked together and did not interfere with each other. And Radio Alice was especially known for its programming that drew inspiration from the Situationists and Dada and has been described as, quote, a mix between a classical medium of militant information and a sort of art experiment in media sabotage, unquote. In 1988, the San Francisco band The Catheads released an album called Submarine with a song called Alice on the Radio. It included bass player Alan Korn, who later became a broadcast lawyer and worked with WGXC to get our FCC broadcast license. He wrote about Radio Alice in this song called Alice on the Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Yeah.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Over the last 6 months, there have been mountain protests across the United States related to the situation taking place in Gaza, where many of the critics of the vast number of civilians being killed, comparing it to genocide. In recent weeks, there's been an escalation of protests at various student college campuses across the country. Probably most noteworthy has been at Columbia University. And on April 30th, for the second time, police were called in and pretty aggressively removed the police, removed the protesters from the college. So we're joined by one of the students at the University of Albany. Anna, as a college student, what is your perspective on the present situation?
I believe that the students have the right to protest because, like, especially the fact that a college campus is a public space, and I fully support what they're doing because they're not being violent with how they're doing it. It's very peaceful protest, kind of how we've seen, I guess, more recently, the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of peaceful protesters that are just being kicked out of where they're protesting. I understand that you do have to have permits to assemble sometimes in those large amounts, but for the most part, it just seems like they're protesting peacefully and the colleges kind of want to shut it down.
Now, one of the arguments being advanced in some quarters, particularly by elected officials, starting with Governor Hochul, has been that the protests against the attacks in Gaza have bordered on anti-Semitism, and that many Jewish students in particular increasingly feel unsafe. You know, what is sort of your perspective on the issue of, you know, has this been a rise in anti-Semiticism?
Yeah, I mean, I am not Jewish, so this is not like an inside perspective. I don't have, like, I cannot tell you how someone of that faith would feel at this moment, but from what I've seen on the outside, and even on my college campus, I have not seen any anti-Semitic, like, on the rise at my school, but I know in some schools, especially early on, there has been. But with some of the protests going on right now where the police are being brought in, I have not seen any big anti-Semitic chants or anything like that. But if that is like a big concern and, you know, maybe I'm just not seeing it, I'm only seeing like, you know, what's being put out. Like maybe there is stuff behind the scenes that do have that. I understand why that would be a big issue because like at the end of the day, no one wants anyone to be hurt during this. We're just protesting, you know, what's going on in Gaza.
Now, for many years, actually for decades, that, you know, Israel has been one of the, what they call a third rail in politics in the United States, and pretty much both major political parties are giving carte blanche support to whatever Israel wants to do. And, you know, older people in general, I think, you know, perhaps mistakenly, but they view Israel as partly sort of an atonement for the world turning a blind eye to the Holocaust and the genocide that took place against Jews, you know, under Hitler and the Nazis. But younger people who, you know, probably did not grow up with the Holocaust being such a strong memory seems much more open to saying, well, you know, it's not that we're anti-Israel, but they really are not properly treated. People, primarily civilians in Palestine. So do you think there's a generational difference between students and older people, how they approach the whole Israel-Palestine conflict?
Yeah, I think there definitely is, because I feel a lot of people getting out. There are students. Yes, there's a lot of people protesting and a lot of people getting out there and being pro-Palestine and saying, you know, fighting for that. But I don't see as much as the older generations. And I think that is because there's so much going on and there's so much money being put into Israel that they do turn the blind eye. I feel like, especially in America, you see that with the next election because people won't vote for Biden or won't vote for Trump because of where they're going to put their money for Israel. And, you know, there's younger politicians who are saying, like, free Gaza. So I think there is a big difference. Relating to the Holocaust, I see a lot of people who, support the freedom of Gaza saying, like, one genocide, like, we're not saying that that wasn't a horrific thing. We're just saying that this is too. Like, it's not, we're not putting that to the side. We understand, like, how big of an, like, catastrophe that was. And that is a horrible thing. And just because we're, you know, saying free Gaza does not mean we're bringing that down in any way.
Now, one of my first jobs actually was the York Campus Association director. At that point was SUNY Albany, you know, 40 years ago. But at that point, there was a very, you know, significant number of Jewish students, you know, on campus. You know, what has been some of the reaction to, you know, to Jewish students? I assume there's still a fair number of Jewish students on campus, you know, to the situation, you know. Obviously, in the larger community, you know, many of the protesters have actually been involved with Jewish Voice for Peace. But what has been the split on the UAlbany campus?
I see on the UAlbany campus a lot of, you know, with Passover coming up or just ended, I see a lot of things for, you know, like events going on related to Passover, or there's tables for Bible studies or stuff like that, but geared towards the Jewish community. Occasionally I see there's a Jewish fraternity. There's like Ask a Rabbi. So there is, like, you do see a presence of religious views on campus, but I've never seen anything negative, like, put on them. I know there was, like, a bake sale that was kosher during Passover or before, maybe in a couple months ago. There is still a presence, but again, like, I'm not in the Jewish community, so maybe there is, like, a bigger presence that I don't see, because I bet there is a club, because there's a bunch of clubs here on campus, and a lot of them, you know, there's religious clubs. But I still see a presence of a Jewish community on campus. Yeah. And I haven't seen anything negative towards them.
Yeah, so we have about 2 minutes left. I understand you're a, you know, political science major. You know, how do you think this present situation and the student protests and the pretty, some would say pretty violent, you know, crackdown by at least some, you know, administrators and politicians on the right to student protests, how is that, you know, sort of impacting, you know, students moving forward? And at the same time, I know a lot of students have also been very upset, rightfully so, about the lack of action on climate. So, you know, are students becoming more politically oriented these days in the last 90 seconds?
I definitely think that is true. Even on this campus, not just with the current, what they're currently protesting, but I do see an increase of political events going on and just an increase of, like, protests, no matter, like, what the cause is on campus. And I think especially since 2020, there has been an increase in the younger generation getting very politically active.
So I do understand, I believe on April 30th, maybe April 29th, there was some protest in support of Gaza at UAlbany. Any sense where the protests are headed, particularly with, you know, many college campuses about to adjourn for the summer in the last 45 seconds?
Yeah, I'm not sure on this campus where it's going to go. I bet there will be continued in New York City because there is such a large population there. In Albany, I'm not sure. I know there was protest at the Capitol as well as on campus, like in front of the Capitol building. And I hope they continue because I think they are getting the message across, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, thank you very much, Anna, for joining us today to talk about the student perspective on the protest. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk magazine.
St. Peter's Health Partners announced on Monday that it will be keeping the Burdette Birth Center open for at least 5 years. This is reversing the course that they were set on for the planned closure by June. Today, I am joined by Rose Mitchell from the Save Burdette Birth Center Coalition, who will give us some more information on this news. First of all, Rose, congratulations. And second, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're so excited to be celebrating this turn of events.
With the help of a $5 million grant, the Burdette Birth Center will remain open for the next 5 years at least. Yeah. When you heard this news, what was your reaction?
Shock and then joy. One of my colleagues from the coalition called me to tell me the news, and it took a few minutes for it to sink in. And then I found myself totally overwhelmed and just like sobbing. I did not expect this outcome. I really thought that St. Peter's was going to fight it to the bitter end, and that I thought that the Attorney General was probably the last hope that we had with her lawsuit to keep them in check and keep the center open. I will be the first to admit that I was feeling pretty cynical about the whole thing. So it's been really just such a joyful thing to be able to celebrate our coalition. It's just been this incredible, diverse group of really committed folks with just so much to give and so much energy. And I'm so proud of what we've done. And I'm so grateful for all of the other various actors that helped make this happen.
Well, your skepticism probably was felt by many in the way things go, but also after the last time that we spoke with you on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, St. Peter's Health Partners CEO, Dr. Stephen Hanks, was pretty much in the tone that he was moving forward no matter what to close down Burdette Birth Center.
That's right. We spoke the day before their public forum at Hudson Valley at the end of February, and the day of that forum, they filed a suit against the Attorney General's office to quash their investigation. And when I saw John McDonald at the event that night, he was just like sardonically furious. You know, there was like he's got a great sense of humor. God bless him, because I don't know how you could do what he does without being able to like laugh from time to time. He was just like kind of with this like chuckle. You know, I just don't know how to get through to these people. And so, yeah, they gave us every indication that they were going to push through and push forward with their closure plan no matter what. I remember someone in the crowd at that event asking, like, so how much money would it take to keep Burdette open? You're citing like a $2.3 or $2.7 million loss. What will it take? And Dr. Hanks responded and said, well, we need an endowment of at least $50 million to keep this facility above water. And I just remember thinking like that's insane. That cannot be true. And that just is proof that they're going to shut this place down no matter what. They want to wash their hands of it. They don't want to be a part of running this facility anymore. So I obviously wish I could have been a fly on the wall in a lot of high level conversations, but Assembly Member John McDonald has proven himself to be a phenomenal ally to the community, as well as to Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and Assemblywoman Amy Pollan, who's the chair of the Assembly Health Committee. They, from what I understand, they all worked together to secure this grant. And however they were able to force St. Peter's to accept it and to agree to continue running the center. You know, I definitely think that the coalition gets some credit because we worked so hard to amplify the voices of the community that were in unison opposed to this closure.
And I wanted to pause right there. It is the Save Burdette Birth Center Coalition, a true grassroots model of organizing, and we don't often see success cases like this. You've mentioned some of the other players that have worked on trying to keep Burdette Birth Center open from Assemblyman John McDonough to many, many others, including, as we heard, Letitia James's state attorney general's office. But I wanted to take a moment and just reflect on this grassroots organizing. Can you just like rewind a little bit in how Save Burdette Birth Center Coalition got off the ground and the impact that it made in networking with the community to keep Burdette open?
It came from a group of really passionate, experienced doulas, the community in Troy, certain key players in Troy, like the staff at the YWCA, and then also over in Albany, BirthNet and the Social Justice Center, folks from those organizations, as well as like those doulas who I mentioned, who know firsthand how important preserving Burdette is, not just for the healthcare access element, but for the really, really special example of the midwifery model of care being allowed to be employed there and achieve excellent results. So that was sort of like the germ, that core group, and they were really did a great job with outreach. It was like a snowball rolling down a mountain. Just so many passionate folks with a lot of different skills and knowledge to offer coming together, and so many meetings talking about what folks knew and who they knew, and bringing together all these different networks. You know, you can never underestimate the power of a network, right? Like, I mean, I think that's one of the really cool things about this coalition is we had like retired healthcare executives. We had like Republican lawmakers, you know, like lots of folks who like, if you were to go point for point, issue for issue, you would find a lot of division, but uniting around the common goal of saving this center and preserving this vital service and the midwifery model of care in Troy and the capital region was just like, it was a no brainer. So definitely like, shout out to the networkers. So yeah, we just had constantly rebuking every point that St. Peter's tried to make about why they felt this closure was necessary, and you know how their closure plan was really inadequate in terms of like, oh well, the midwives will just go over to Albany and do their deliveries there, not addressing the difficulties around transportation and emergency responses, you know, response times in the city of Troy, and just like really doggedly pursuing the truth and justice throughout the whole process.
As we start to wrap up here, Rose, it remains to be the only birth center in Rensselaer County. And I'm sure you're still adjusting to the news that Burdette Birth Center will remain open. And it is only promised for 5 years. So I'm curious if yet the Save Burdette Birth Center Coalition knows what it will be doing to advocate for this being a permanent decision.
We are just still very much in like reflection and celebration mode. I know that, you know, the plan is to continue to stay in touch with the folks who work at Burdette and to provide whatever support we can. This is a grant, so there's going to be certain requirements that need to be met, and we don't know those details, and whether or not we're even privy to those details remains to be seen. We're here, but you're absolutely right. We know that we can't stop holding these health systems accountable. They make a promise to the community. And, you know, we know that while we may have preserved Burdette, there's probably going to be other cuts that they're going to try to make to other types of services. We are going to continue to fight in whatever capacity we can to make sure that the community gets the services that they need. And folks were chanting, five more years at the press conference yesterday. And I was like, no, forever, like indefinite. We can't just like, we can't rest on this. At the end of the day, these are multi-million-dollar and sometimes billion-dollar organizations that have their own bottom line and their own best interests in mind. And at the core of all of the decisions they make, regardless of what their mission statement and their vision are, these are huge corporations disguised as nonprofits. And unfortunately, we depend on them for healthcare. One of the most important things that we were fighting for was the preservation of the midwifery model of care. Yes, Burdette is the only labor and delivery unit in Rensselaer County, and it serves a really wide service area, but it's also the only place in the capital region where midwives are in charge, and they have achieved excellent outcomes, and they have phenomenal statistics, and they do that in a medium risk population. Their model, it needs to be protected at all costs, and it needs to be proliferated around the region. We should be doing everything we can to get healthcare systems to incorporate midwifery into their, you know, into their labor and delivery services.
Awesome. Rose Mitchell, thank you and congratulations.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Congratulations to everyone. This is a win for the whole community. We're just so pleased.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Thank you.
That was Alice Coltrane with her 1971 song Journey into Sachidanada from the album of the same name with Pharoah Sanders.
New maps show the extent of New York State's lead pipe replacement program. They demonstrate progress in replacing lead service lines, although the state still has an estimated 494,000 of them. The Environmental Protection Agency awarded New York more than $300 million over the last 3 years for this, but only $104 million has been awarded to municipalities. Josh Kleinberg with the New York League of Conservation Voters says additional state funds can replace more lines.
There are 24 projects that were funded from that $104 million that went out, which is great. But as I mentioned, though, there were an additional 85 other projects requesting money as well, totaling $211 million that went unfunded because there's no additional money.
The Rensselaer County Legislature passed a resolution urging New York State to allocate more funding to lead pipe replacement. The EPA's new lead and copper rule, expected this October, will give municipalities nationwide a decade to replace all existing lead pipes. Kleinberg says when that happens, competition for labor and materials will be fierce. The rule's 10-year clock could start in 2027. State dollars for this work are in the Clean Water Infrastructure Act and the Environmental Bond Act, but don't match federal funds. A major challenge to replacing lead service lines is having an accurate inventory of these lines. Cities such as Troy are working with homeowners to get that information. Kleinberg says replacing lead pipes benefits a municipality's water infrastructure.
We spend a tremendous amount of money on that infrastructure. For that last bit, to not consider that part of the overall infrastructure, which is the most critical point, this is, I think, what the rethinking of this inventory project is about.
Beyond national maps, New York's Lead Pipe Right to Know Act requires information about where lead pipes are located to be easily accessible online for New Yorkers to access. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Trump can't win, but Biden can lose, meaning Trump's polling at his peak, pretty much in all the swing states. He's basically polling at the best he has, at the best he can get, and Biden's underperforming everywhere.
Republican former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan says he expects the presidential race to be close. Ryan is criticizing his party as Trump-oriented and chaotic, noting that intra-party fights helped push him out of Congress. Polls do show a tight race. Former President Donald Trump was stuck in a New York court yesterday while the porn star he is accused of paying off gave a detailed account of the sex Trump denies took place. Meanwhile, federal Judge Eileen Cannon is indefinitely delaying Trump's separate document trial. It was set to begin later this month, but Cannon cited the complex legal rules around using classified evidence. But President Joe Biden faces a different challenge, trying to strike a balance on the war in Gaza. Yesterday, he condemned the rise in anti-Semitism during Israel's war against Hamas. Speaking at a Holocaust remembrance event on Capitol Hill, he said the ancient hatred of Jews didn't end after World War II.
This hatred continues to lie deep in the heart of too many people in the world and requires our continued vigilance and outspokenness.
Negotiators from Israel have returned to the Cairo ceasefire negotiations, but tanks have also closed the Rafah border. The sticking point seems to be the length of a pause in fighting. Meanwhile, North Carolina Republican Representative Virginia Fox says presidents of Yale, UCLA, and University of Michigan will be called to testify before Congress about their handling of anti-Semitism and pro-Palestine protests.
Congress will not tolerate your dereliction of duty to your Jewish students. American universities are officially put on notice that we have come to take our universities back.
But students may not be the issue. The New York police say more than half of the 170 arrested at a city college protest weren't enrolled at the school. A third of those arrested at Columbia weren't either. Kalia Ann Mendoza with anti-war group Nonviolent Peace Force faults administrators for bringing in the cops.
School administrators should be meeting with students and should not escalate to this point. These students are unarmed. They are engaged in practicing peaceful, nonviolent protest, which is a fundamental human right.
A proposed New York State Equal Rights Amendment won't be on the ballot this November after a judge ruled that lawmakers missed a procedural step. The legislature didn't get a legal opinion from the Attorney General on the measure to protect trans and reproductive rights. Supporters argue that step has been missed in past proposals. South Dakota's primary next month will be the first national election since ballot drop boxes were banned there. It's one of 12 states to ban drop boxes, though there's no proven connection between drop boxes and voter fraud or stolen ballots. Member of the Rosebud Sioux and State Senator Sean Bordeaux says the ban's unfair to rural and tribal voters.
It was something that a lot of people utilized on our reservation communities where you might have to travel 70 miles to go vote.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Today we're looking at a principle called the Gingles test that federal courts use when determining whether a gerrymandered redistricting map is a violation of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. How that test is interpreted can determine whether minority voters can elect the candidate of their choice or their vote is diluted by an anti-voter state legislature. A group of black voters sued the North Carolina legislature in 1982, arguing their voting districts violated the Voting Rights Act by diluting their vote and keeping black North Carolinians from electing the candidate of their choice. Before it came to trial, Congress clarified the VRA to say intentional discrimination didn't need to be proved, just the effect of discrimination was enough to be a violation of Section 2. Thornburg v. Gingles created a three-part test for federal courts to use when considering whether a VRA violation had occurred. It stipulates the minority group is sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a single-member district. The minority group is politically cohesive, usually voting the same way, and the white majority votes sufficiently as a block, usually defeating the minority's preferred candidate. As shown in the recent overturning of Louisiana's new congressional map, the interpretation of geographically compact and politically cohesive still leaves wiggle room for discrimination. We have more on Gingles and the VRA at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.